I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 176 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. If you'd like to support this podcast, please go to caropop.com. This week's guest is Cheryl Pavelski, a founder and owner of the Omnivore Recordings label and producer of the recent deluxe editions of Wilco's A Ghost Is Born and Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, and many other ambitious compilations. Winner of 4 Grammy Awards, Pavelski is one of those rare people who has turned her passion into a successful career. We spoke, though, at a relative low point. Her house in Altadena, California, was one of the thousands of homes destroyed in the Los Angeles area wildfires earlier this year. Her wife, Audrey Bilger, is the president of Reed College in Portland, Oregon. So the two of them spend much of their time there. When Pavelski and I spoke, she had yet to return to Altadena to see the damage. She's a collector of records and other memorabilia, some of which had made it up to Portland, some of which had not. Pavelski grew up in Milwaukee in a musical household and taught herself guitar. She's someone who read liner notes and immersed herself in music. Her desire to be involved in that world took her to Los Angeles, where she worked at Capitol Records, Rhino Records, which you heard about last week with Patrick Milligan, and Concord. In 2010, she launched her own label, Omnivore, which has released music by such Caro Pop favorites as Big Star and Chris Bell, Camper Van Beethoven, The Baseball Project, Young Fresh Fellows, Steve Wynn and the Dream Syndicate, The Continental Drifters, Peter Hulsapple, The Cowsills, Game Theory, Ian Matthews, Sam Phillips, and Urge Overkill. Here she discusses how she researched, compiled, and produced lavish reissues, often working directly with the musicians, by such artists as The Band, The Smithereens, The Beach Boys, Pat Benatar, Grand Funk Railroad, and the Miles Davis Quintet. Her work on the Grammy-winning 2023 7-CD set Written in Their Soul, the Stax Songwriter Demos, took 17 years. She also gets into her long association with Wilco, including work on the Alpha Mike Foxtrot, Summer Teeth, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, and Ghost Is Born boxes. Why does she call the Grammy-winning Yankee Hotel Foxtrot box a Rubik's Cube of a project? How does she unearth the rare materials for these compilations? Does she prefer CD or vinyl box sets? Why does she say it's a horrible time to have a record label, yet love what she's doing? There are few people in the music industry, particularly women, doing the kind of work that Pavelski's been doing. For those of us who love music like she does, her story is inspirational. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Cheryl Pavelski.
Printed my name on the back of a leaf, and I watched it float away.
Did you get down to LA and see your place?
No, not yet. We were in Texas when it happened. We had a conference for Audrey's work, and then we went to see her mom real quick because she was in Dallas. And so again, it was weird. It's weird, you know, people, friends on our street had to evacuate, so they have a real sense of what happened, and we're just so disconnected to it. So but we're going back, so I'm not sure if I want to.
Where is the house?
Altadena. I mean, just such a unbelievably beautiful space. I mean, we've been there since 97, but you know, we rented for a few years. Even the house that we rented is gone, you know? Mm. So I think, you know, everything that we loved about Altadena has pretty much been leveled, with the exception of the community there. And I hope that remains intact, because it was special. You know, I go hiking up on the mountain every morning that I could, because, you know, there were actual rocket scientists there because of JPL. There were, you know, all the crazy, brilliant Caltech people, a lot of academics. And we sort of, we soak in that world, obviously, but also all of the, you know, huge arts community, music, filmmakers, animators, you know, everybody. So it was, you know, that community, I hope it can remain intact. I mean, this is quite a blow for a lot of people, you know, because especially in the arts community, you don't necessarily have a 401k and, you know, health insurance and all the other stuff that normal corporate America people have. So
right.
I think the financial hardship is going to be pretty severe for some people.
Is there a good network of people in Altadena and also just in the music industry and entertainment industry, kind of, you know, letting people know what's happened to who and who needs support and all of yeah. that? And have you felt that?
I've felt very disconnected, but you know, there's some really amazing, and here's the thing, like, you know, at the end of the day, what you need, somebody said this on a Facebook page, for Altadena, which has been just a absolute godsend of information. That's been incredible. I was so far ahead of everything, just watching that information roll by and people trying to figure it all out like we were, you know. But, you know, also on that page, I saw somebody said this, and I'll continue to quote it. What people need whose houses have burned down or they've been displaced for who knows how long is time and money. And nobody can give you that, you know.
Yeah.
Nobody can give us the time I've lost for the last month from my work and from Audrey's work, you know, essentially working for the insurance companies and FEMA and SBA and all of this stuff that you have to do. It's really a deluge of stuff that you don't know. So you spend all the time on the webinars and on the community Zoom meetings and
right.
You know, so it's time and money. Like if somebody's, you know, nobody's going to turn down money, but that might interfere with insurance, you know? So there's all of this stuff and, you know, the grift is real. So everything that you need to do on your to-do list, you actually have to double check, like, is that person who got in touch with me from FEMA actually a FEMA person? Or is it somebody that's looking for information for identity theft? And it's happening.
It's so sad that you have to even deal with that on top of everything else.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, but it's just like,
yeah,
of all the things to worry about.
Well, you know, and so, you know, you call FEMA, you find out if that person is a FEMA representative, you call that person back, you know, it took you twice as long. Great. But, you know, it's so important to be as cautious as you can. And it's, you know, it's sort of like the proverbial onion, you know, I don't know when I'm going to get down to the emotional part of this, because everything keeps piling up on top of it, you know?
Yeah.
So that'll be fun.
I'm sorry. And you were a collector too, right? I mean, you have like a lot of music and memorabilia and stuff. Was that all in that house? I mean, like, what's the...
You know, it's split up because I really love my wife. So I try to spend as much time with her as possible, you know? So a lot of things had to... a lot of my work stuff had to come to Portland with me because my... you know, the collection isn't just a collection. It's a working library, you know? So I have... you know, a series of the Greenwood Press super academic nerdy discographies, you know. They're very valuable books, but they had to come with me, you know. But there was, you know, I had two file copies of pretty much everything, you know, of value that I had produced, you know.
Right.
So there was a collection, sort of an archive of my stuff that was just mine. Just, you know, I have plenty of information on the things I produced, but, you know, I had a sealed one and an open one in case I had to go back and look at this and here's
right.
the, you know. And so, you know, it's stuff like that. You know, I certainly didn't move the 78s because they, I mean, some of them are so fragile, you look at them wrong and they break. So, you know, so there, you know, there was stuff like that. There was, you know, recent things like, from last, Solid Sound Wilco's festival, Steve Keen, the artist, was there painting things. And, because we had one for Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, I got a Steve Keen painting of the cover of Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. And that
oh,
is
nice. Number,
so. Yeah. So I'm gonna
are there to, more to be had of that?
I think he would paint it if I asked him to. I haven't gotten to that. I'm
all
still
if you're listening.
I'm still, you know,
we can make one thing right in this world, at least.
Right.
We can take care of that. Are there things that you collected when you were growing up in Milwaukee that you had like in a special little area? I mean, are there mm-hmm. kind of your earliest efforts at collecting in music fandom that are hanging around or were hanging around somewhere?
Yes. I hope some of them are here. I know for sure some of them are gone. Like my dad, who's gone, he painted a painting of that house that we were going to frame and put up in the living room, and that was there, you know. So that's, you can't get those things back. But you know, I think my first 45s are probably here. So you know, like Anne Murray's Snowbird on the Budget label.
Was that your first 45, Anne Murray's Snowbird?
Well, I made my grandma buy me two. I also got Candyman by Sammy Davis Jr. So
was that after you'd seen Willy Wonka?
No. I didn't see Willy Wonka until I was older, and then it just didn't land for me.
Willy Wonka was the first movie I ever saw where I was mad because they changed the book. You know, I was probably eight. Wow. I was probably like eight or something, but I'd read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and I'm like, first of all, I'm like, why is it called Willy Wonka? It's about the kid, not the grown up. And then the Oompa Loompa songs are different than what's in the book. Like somehow I thought you had to put the same songs in. So
you're a very discriminating 8-year old.
I was you could tell that I was going to become a film critic for a while because I was like, right, that was my first. And my first single, I think, was the first two I remember having were Rockin' Robin, Michael Jackson, and Little Bitty Pretty One, Jackson 5.
Those are good.
So, yeah, I got them. I still have them somewhere.
Yeah, see, that's, then you're kooky like me.
Absolutely. Well, part of the reason I was so looking forward to talking with you is because you are someone who figured out how to turn a love of music into a career.
Yes.
Doing this stuff. And I think that there are a lot of people who wish they could do that. And so you're going to impart the secret of it all.
Oh boy. I think it's sort of, what they say about being an artist. You know, if it's something that you can't not do, you figure out how to do it, you know? And, you know, I line that up with you make your own luck, which means, you know, you wind up working twice as hard as everybody else, maybe sometimes three times, and eventually out. You know, that's my advice, because you know, it's and who knows, you know, people ask me that about the music business all the time, and you know, the music business is so different from when I started that you know, I have no advice for, you know, kids that want to go into music now. You know, I would say a whole bunch of negative things that probably aren't right, because it's a different experience for them now, you know?
You and I could do a great panel for young people where they ask us about futures in the music business and journalism, and we just go, I don't know.
Yeah, sorry. You got to make it up now. You
got to come up with a new model.
Yeah, for sure. And, but I think, you know, turning your obsession into a profession is still possible, right? You know? So, but it's like what I said, is if you can't not do it, then you figure out how to do it. That doesn't guarantee you're going to be successful and be able to pay the bills though, you know?
So you're growing up in Milwaukee and you loved music. Mm-hmm. You played music too, right? Like what were you thinking at the time when you sort of got this bug? Did you think, I'm going to be a performer, I'm going to work behind the scenes? Like, what was the thought process?
I didn't care. I was, you know, I was taking apart radios and putting them back together to figure out how they worked. I was reading every label and every jacket and, you know, just to figure out, okay, what does ASCAP mean? That's hidden code, you know, just trying to figure out everything. And so, you know, it was a natural thing. And, you know, Milwaukee is a very musical town, just because of, the people that settled there, you know, listen, Italian, Irish, German, Polish, they are people who like to party and play music. So, you know, even the African American community there, you know, just a stone's throw from Chicago, you have all of the blues influence. I mean, it was a really great place to grow up for music, because, art was valued there, you know. Yeah. It was a community that you know, there were always racial tensions, but there was a real love of the all kinds of art. So I was surrounded by it. So it was kind of natural for me to just want to do music any way I could. So that meant, okay, well, I'm going to get a guitar and other things with strings and try to figure out how to play it too. And, you know, I kind of realized early on that I could probably be a songwriter. I loved performing, loved it, but it probably wasn't going to be the thing that I did, because I also really like records. And I really, really like records, and I like the things of records, and I like the production of records. And it was really just that time in Milwaukee was trying to figure out how to get to that thing. Like, how can I be a part of making that thing?
Right.
You know, so
did you teach yourself guitar, by the way?
No, my dad was a musician, and he actually taught accordion at Lincoln Music House. So I bugged him and bugged him and bugged him until he set me up with like the cool groovy guitar teacher. And you know, unfortunately, and I think this happens to a lot of people, when you're a kid, you're it hurts,
right?
So you don't have calluses yet, and your fingers just you know, it's you don't have the strength or the reach. So, you know, it was just one of those things where I think a lot of people try it and then put it away for a while. And that, you know, that's what happened to me, even though I had, you know, my groovy guitar guy was like, okay, so now we're going to learn Deep Purple. And I'm like, cool. You know? But I didn't get a lot of theory. And so, you know, there's just these gaps, and it was frustrating for me. And, you know, so I think there's a lot about, you know, a lot of people's early trying to play music, that the access points where something would click, you know, that the timing is wrong, or you didn't have the best teacher for that kind of stuff, right? Because you've probably had this experience, like when something makes sense and it's right, and you know, something just clicks in. And it just didn't do that for me. So, you know, had I pursued like songwriting and performing further than I did, which was pretty long, you know, I would have been the person that feels their way through, as opposed to really knows how to properly employ the circle of fifths, you know.
Right.
So but you know, by the time I got to LA and was temping at Capitol Records, you know, I was in the zone. So
you graduated from Marquette, and then you moved to LA, and you're just like, I just need a job somewhere in the industry so I can get my foothold.
Yeah. I quit my job in Milwaukee to go work at the record store, a place called Radio Doctors, because I felt like I really needed to know more about distribution.
And that was in Milwaukee.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the time, Narada Records, the new age label, was based in Milwaukee, weirdly enough. And I went and applied there, and they were like, go away, kid, you bother me, you know? So I did. I went to LA, and there was a brilliant program at Capitol Records called the Floater Pool. And you had to go and sign up at a temp agency and say you only wanted to work in music. And if you were lucky, you could become a part of Capitol's Floater Pool, and you had to promise to only work at Capitol Records. So the problem was, if you didn't work all week, you know, like nobody got sick, nobody was on vacation, right? But if somebody went on a 2-week vacation, you might get put in publicity for 2 weeks. And then the next time you got called, you might be in the finance department. And the next time you got called, you might be helping out in the mastering studios. So if you were serious, you stuck with it, even though you might not eat for a few weeks, because you were pinging around that tower. You were learning how Capitol Records worked, and people were learning about you. And so the Floater Pool was a feeder program for their entry-level positions, and it was brilliant. I think Hale Milgram, the president at the time, started it, because he started at the, you know, in the Warner mailroom. You know, so I think he saw the value of sort of checking people out that way, you know.
Was it a thrill for you walking into that Capitol building?
Oh, my God. Every day. You know, one of my first temp gigs there was being Hale's assistant's assistant. And I, you know, Hale and I check in every couple of years now. I mean, I still know him, you know, and it's amazing. So, and a lot of people that were part of that floater pool were, you know, they now own companies or they're in super high positions at different labels and different, you know, music business adjacent places. So it's real cool because I can pick up the phone and bark at one of my pals and go, get it done, you know, and it's great. It's great to have that sort of common foundation.
What was the first project that you were able to produce, compile, you know, get off the ground?
Yeah, I did a ton of them that there were no credits for, because when I first got to work in quote unquote A&R, you know, it was in an area called special markets. So and we were doing things called premiums we handled all the licensing. Premiums were things like fill up your tank, get a country cassette, right?
There you go.
Right. And so I did a lot of those, but you know, I also worked on the first Starbucks release, which was Blue Note Blend, and you know, involved in licensing to, you know, labels like Collector's Choice and One Way and Mosaic and all of these things. So I produced a ton of jukebox 45s, you know. So it was all this ancillary, non-traditional retail. So the idea was
this for Capitol, or was this like you on your own doing stuff?
No, Capitol.
Okay.
Yeah, it was my job. Yeah. So I was in that area called Special Markets, which was, where do we put music in front of the buying public that is non-traditional retail, right? Plus all the licensing. So licensing repertoire to other labels and sync licensing for film and TV. So it was a great education, and it was really an awesome way to learn how to not just produce a record that goes to a record store, right? You know, suddenly they're in Starbucks and Barnes and Noble or Pottery Barn. And what's the other one I'm thinking of? Not Barnes and Noble. It's something and something. I don't know. It was another one of those retail places that sell plates and forks and things.
Williams and Sonoma.
That's it. Yeah.
Really?
Williams Sonoma.
So you just Williams Sonoma. There's no end in there.
Yeah. No, we did a bunch of stuff for them, like Asian Cooking Month. So, you know, like themed things. So it made me use all of that music knowledge that I'd been amassing up until that point in a real sort of thematic, sometimes very specific, different way than a lot of other people were using it. But the first projects I did, because it was a 1-2 punch for Capitol. I worked with my longtime friends now, the Smithereens, and I did.
Oh, nice.
Their first best of. I'm sorry, that was a windy way to get to that, but
No. We're all about the wind. this is a relaxed conversation.
We're breaking the wind here, but
we're breaking. Yeah, we're the windbreakers. Yes.
So Blown to Smithereens, their sort of best of greatest hits up to that point, and then Attack of the Smithereens, which was a rarities package.
Right.
So I'd pitched that to Wayne Watkins, who was the head of catalog at the time, and they finally relented and let me do a project and turned into two, and it was great because, you know, like Dennis and Jim from the Smithereens, just longtime friends now, you know.
Yeah, I had Dennis on, and I had on Don Dixon and Ed Stasium.
I love
Smithereens.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
I have this vivid memory. This is just a side, which isn't that relevant. Sorry, people. but when I drove back from college, it was like I was driving back from Philadelphia after graduating, and you know, it's like I knew I was back because I could hear WXRT, which was, you know, the station where I learned stuff. And I remember, like, we left at like noon in Philadelphia, and we're driving like 2-3 in the morning, getting onto the expressway, and I heard Blood and Roses for the first time, 3 in the morning, and I was just like, who is this? This is so cool. And it's just like, you know, just getting back to Chicago after all that driving and then hearing Blood and Roses. So I've always had like this very specific, aside from the fact that I, you know, then, you know, loved their records and I used to interview Pat Denizio for stories as well. So anyway, good first project.
Yeah, it was. It was. And I was, you know, you're not always lucky to get to work with musicians that are also giant music nerds in the way that, you know, like Dennis, those guys, all of those guys, they really know their stuff, you know, and they were very kind. You know, I was, I say that about Robbie Robertson too, because later I got to do all the band stuff and he was, those guys were patient and kind because, you know, I was a sprout. You know, and I just wanted, you know, I was in there like slashing away, trying to like get credits and get known so I could do more cool stuff. And, you know, they were so tolerant, but, you know, and I was, you know, it was spooky. You know, it's scary to walk into a room with people whose music you've been listening to as a fan and then try to work with them. And sometimes tell them what you think,
right?
You know, it's just sort of like, yeah, well, they were in the room because they made that, you know, and here I am, I'm just sort of like, wow, I don't think that, you know, this isn't good enough, or I think there's you know, and there's that stuff worked for me. It's not like I was, you know, I didn't have an ego about it. It was more from like a, holy shit, I hope I know what I'm doing kind of thing, you know? But
yeah, you did the band A Musical History and that came out in 2005.
Yeah.
There's five CDs and a DVD. Yeah. So is that you having the idea, like, let's do a band box, or does someone come to you and say, hey, we want your help on this and here's Robbie Robertson and you're going to work with him on it?
Well, that came out of, I was sitting in, special markets for a long time, as I said, and there was this, budget catalog, that was just sort of records that, you know, the main label had felt they had lived their usefulness, but there might be like a secondary market in the budget world, right? Cutout bin stuff, and it always bugged me that Stage Fright was in the budget catalog, so
right,
I kept bugging people at Capitol about it, and. Seriously, you know, I think what the salesperson said to me was, Cheryl, you know, we all really, the band is important, but, you know, they just don't sell records. So, you know, can you stop bugging us about this? And I'm like, nope, cannot. Because the thing is that, you know, in the hallowed halls of the major labels at the time, there were people would call somebody like Frank Sinatra or the Beach Boys franchise artists. Right? Because they're perennials. It's like Dark Side of the Moon and Pet Sounds. You can't not sell it, right? It's just everybody goes through that phase where they learn those records. And so they keep selling. They didn't consider the band of that caliber, which blew my tiny little kid brain. And so I kept bugging them about it. And finally they relented. And I said, well, we should really do... you know, all the reissues, but maybe we should do this box set first. And so I started, you know, they were like, oh, God, fine. You know, finally I got to a certain place in the organization where I was working, you know, I was no longer in special markets. I was one of the catalog people. And so maybe I carried a little more water by that point, but so that, you know, they agreed. And I said, you know, the band will never become a franchise artist unless you make them that, because, you know, to begin with, you know, Foreigner doesn't become Foreigner unless you dump a bunch of money into Foreigner and tell people how awesome Foreigner is. Right. And I think it's the same in catalog. If you don't say that this band is important and explain why, then they fall by the wayside. So, you know, I got my way, but I was, you know, again, coming out of that like early stages where I was kind of like, do I know what I'm doing? You know, I started going through the vaults, And somehow Robbie got wind of it. And I hadn't called him up to that point. He called me. And I was like, oh, shit. and he's like, hey, I hear you're going through our stuff. And I was like, yeah. And he said, why haven't you called me? And I said, because I wanted to have my shit together when I did. And he was like, oh, well, that's refreshing. Why don't you come over and let's sit down and talk about this? And so that I still have projects that I need to get done for him, you know, up until the end. You know, he's another, you know, all these people, you know, you have these relationships with them. And, you know, it was really, that was a special relationship for me. And also because I think he was tolerant of me because his kids are my age. Like I know his kids, you know, so I think he was used to hearing sort of people my age kind of weighing in on things, you know, but he was great. And I hope we can really honor him by getting this other project done that he wanted to get done. So
did he have like materials that you didn't have access to? He's like, well, why don't you use this? We got this. Or was it all stuff that was in the quote unquote vault that you were able to go through?
There was stuff in different places. But he certainly had a, storage, you know, that, I wound up going through some of it. You know, you never have enough time. I try to, you know, I like to be as comprehensive as possible. But you know, when you only have a set amount of time and there's unmarked cassettes, you know, it's yeah. Like, okay, now I often afford myself the luxury of that time when I'm working on projects for my label, our label at Omnivore. And I am afforded that time when I consult to certain artists like Wilco, you know, they're like, just, you know, here, go through it. And they're awesome because, you know, I'm like, could you look under your bed again? You know, like, sorry, it's me again. Yeah. You think there's nothing there, but I kind of know there is. Let's just find that stuff. So, you know, it's really nice these days to kind of have that benefit of time.
With the band, did you have to navigate with the other members of the band too? Or was it just like, this is a Robbie project you're working on?
I mostly dealt with Robbie, but, you know, there were times when I had spoken to Levon and his folks, you know, Richard was gone. I talked to Garth a lot. Garth and I had fun because, growing up in Milwaukee, I know from the polka, it turns out he was a big polka fan, which, you know, also,
who knew?
Who knew? So we started trading cassettes of polka, and it was awesome. So I have these cassettes, and he had this very beautiful handwriting. So I, you know, I have the little J cards with his handwriting, and he was great. He was good at remembering stuff, but you know, I think a lot of bands have that one person that's sort of more archivally minded, and that was certainly, you know, Robbie was in the business, you know, in a different capacity. So I think that he certainly felt a lot of responsibility to look after the legacy of the band.
Was that sort of an eye-opening experience for you, just working with an artist that closely on, I mean, you've done this a lot. Yeah. Was that like a key sort of formative experience, or were there other ones that also?
Yeah. Well, yeah. In every way. But, you know, at the time I was also, gosh, I got to think back. I mean, it was Beach Boys, Pat Benatar, Grand Funk, you know, older stuff.
You had Miles Davis Quintet was right after that, it looks like.
Yeah, that was at Concord. That was a little bit later. I still work with the Peggy Lee Estate. I had the pleasure of meeting Peggy once. It was at, and it, you know, I was just even lucky to be there, but it was the Capitol 50th anniversary party. Mm. So there were a couple people there that I got to meet, but you know, it's like Martin Denny, You know, his birthday and my birthday are a day apart. And he'd call me from Hawaii and he'd be like,
Nice.
"Hey, doll, happy birthday." You know, and I'd be like, "Oh, Mr. Denny." You know, and so there were people like that, that, and, you know, I loved the legacy of Capitol Records because it was the, you know, it was the West Coast upstart independent label at the time when it was founded, right? So, you know, when I first started working there, there was this woman that I worked with who had gotten the first typewriter at Capitol, right? Like
Whoa.
these were like lifers, and I loved it because they had all of this institutional knowledge, and I was trying to gobble up as much as I could, you know. And I hate that it's no longer an independent, you know. I hate that it's just an imprint now, but what can you do? This is all ephemeral.
Still got a building named after it though, so that's something.
It's for sure.
Is there like a little closet somewhere where they have all these extra like Beetle Butcher covers that have not been opened?
Well,
I'd be like looking around for that. I wouldn't find it, I'm sure, but
the coolest thing was one time when I was there, the Beastie Boys came and they tagged a bunch of stuff, right? They had came in with Kansas spray paint. And they painted over a lot of them, but if there is a God, the one inside, if you go up to the top, to the rooftop, before you can go up to the rooftop, there's an electrical panel, and on the inside of it, it's tagged. And
wow.
I think they left that one. So I don't know how much, you know, how much is left there, because I'm sure that place has been. So many people have gone through there now. It can't, it, there can't be any, there is no hidden closet filled with cool stuff. I can tell you that.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's popular anti-hero IPA combines five classic U.S. hop varieties with bold citrus, floral, and pine aromas. And with the weather heating up, cold time sure hits the spot. This premium lager is an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. The brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. You worked at Capitol. You were also at Kraft. You did a lot of stuff with Rhino. I have the Where the Action Is Los Angeles Nuggets box, which you and Andrew Sandoval worked on, which is very
Yeah,
cool.
Alec Pleo, that was those guys just did an incredible job on that. That was really their baby born out of love, you know. I mean, there's a Andrew's got such a deep knowledge of LA music history, that era, you know. He's amazing. But yeah, it was Concord before it was Kraft, and before then. So my now partner at Omnivore, Greg Allen, and I kind of worked as consultants for Rhino when they had Rhino Handmade. So we were
Right.
doing that sort of as a little team of consultants. Then I went to Concord. Then I went to Rhino as the head of A&R for a couple of years, and then they blew that up. And I said, you know, I think it's okay now to, you know, I always felt like I didn't know enough to start a label. But after Rhino, I'm like, yeah, you know, I want to build something. I don't want to keep starting over. So that's why we did that.
When you started the label, were there certain bands you thought, oh, I'm gonna, you know, I mean, we're gonna start this label and I'm gonna do some big star stuff, or I'm gonna do some whatever. I mean, because you have like, put it this way, when I look at the lineup of Omnivore Records and the ones that I've bought, which is a lot of them, you know, I can
Thank you.
tell that we have pretty simpatico
Buy
musical
some
tastes.
more.
Oh no, you had a CD sale recently and I loaded up on a bunch of those, like I think around the end of the year. But no, I mean, it's like I think of just the people who have been on my podcast. I mean, I've had, you know, Jody Stevens, a big star, and I've had Susan Kousel, and I've had three coming up to four members of the Baseball Project. So yeah, so you have cool stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's by that point I'd been so many places, and you know, the four of us at Omnivore have been in the business for decades, and so, you know, collectively we know a lot of people, and some things were a logical extension, right? You know, I think we started started the Big Star Keep an Eye on the Sky set at Concord, took it through to Rhino, came out on Rhino, but then, you know, there was more to do. So I just kept doing it.
Right.
Because, you know, I'd gotten to be really good friends with John Fry, and, you know, Jody's wonderful human, as you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it made a lot of sense just to keep going, and, you know, why not? So we did, I think the first thing we did was the test pressing edition of Third for that Record Store Day.
Right. But I picked that up.
Yeah, that was inspired. That was a good one. But you know, there was the documentary being made, so it made sense that we worked on that and put out the soundtrack. So, you know, a lot of these things, you know, it's just from being in the business for so long. And so I love it when, you know, artists own their own stuff, especially stuff that comes before their first record, because it really adds another page to how the fans understand that band. You know, it's a different window in. So I look for that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's always an open door for those sorts of projects, because I, you know, for whatever reason, I, you know, even all the way back to Capitol, the stuff I was really obsessed with was what didn't make the record and why, you know? So we do a lot of that kind of stuff. And I've done a lot of that throughout my career. You know, my favorite one is the Stax songwriter demos, because, you know, the what ifs on that set are amazing. You know, like, why didn't this get cut? This would have been a hit. And so, you know, and that's same thing with, you know, every artist we've talked about so far. It's just sort of like, well, you know, why didn't this make it? Or, you know, what is this lost chapter here? You know, and I've, again, like I have the luxury and privilege, and I'm so grateful that I get to go digging around.
Right.
And I hope that serves a purpose, you know, for the people that love certain artists and their music.
But these are artists that you love too. I mean, it seems like that you're not going to listen to 2000 hours of Stax demos unless you really like Stax demos.
Yeah. Well, I think Stax is one of the most important labels ever, you know. It's a real time documentary, you know, of that era of our history. But, you know, so there's also a lot to love. I mean, the groove was deep.
Absolutely. I had William Bell on last year and he was fantastic, but it's just like, you know, if you're talking about like Stax and, you know, the history of it, I mean, he's right there at the beginning. And, you know, You Don't Miss Your Water is like one of the great songs of all time. And, you know, Born Under a Bad Sign, and these solo records he did were terrific too. So,
yeah. And he's a sweetheart.
And he was really nice. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
totally.
I got to get Carla Thomas now. She's like the next one on my list.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah. Eddie Floyd is fun too. He's got all kinds of stories. You know, who another great one is Bobby Manuel. He's a guitar player with Isaac Hayes, but wrote an awful lot with Betty Crutcher.
Oh, nice. And
all these guys are filled with such amazing stories. And of course, Deanie Parker. That was sort of the main group of people that I got to, again, lucky me, sit on panels with. I mean, I looked down the line at, and Henderson Thigpen. So the five or six of us would go and do these panels for that box set. And, you know, I'm up there just going, I don't need to be here. I want to hear their stories, you know, but
right.
I was a little bit of the connective tissue on that, but boy, they're just so great. And they crack each other up, and the stories are amazing.
How does it work that you're running your own label, but you're also able to do these really ambitious projects for other labels?
Well, it took 17 years to finish the Stax project. I mean, I started it when I was at Concord, and I just kept going. It was fortunate that they were interested in putting it out when I finally got it
And Concord had the rights to all the music. They have the Stax catalog and stuff.
Yeah. Anything that's unissued that's considered a Stax master belongs to Concord. So, you know, but the material came from the publisher. So I was, I had it. And so I was just able to continue working on it, you know? So I surprised myself when I finished the last file and I was like, I was just curious. I would listen to stuff on planes and when I had some spare listening time, but it was fortunate that, you know, I had worked there and then I still had friends there. And one of the guys I worked at Rhino with was at Concord. So, you know, and I knew he was a fan of that kind of music. So, you know, it just all sort of added up, but, you know, I like doing this work. You know, I always say some women knit, some women crochet, I make discographies, you know, it's you know, it's just, and you know, that's one of the reasons, you know, my wife Audrey, after the whole Rhino thing, she was like, well, maybe it's time to start your own label. And I said, well, you know, we're going to have to hitch up our britches. We're going to be poor. And she's like, well, I can work on that. And she did pretty good. You know? But she said, you know, you work all the time and, you know, all of these other companies benefit from this. And also a lot of times they don't respect what you do. So why wouldn't you do it with people that you care about, for artists that you care about, you know, and put all of that energy into something that benefits you instead. So I said, that is solid reasoning. That's why you are a college president. And I'm over here making records.
There you go. Doing what you love though. So
yeah, for sure.
So you started Omnivore in 2010. Now here we are 15 years later.
Yeah, you know, crazy.
Vinyl's made a comeback. CDs are maybe going in the other direction. Like how has the business of running a label changed since you founded it?
You know, I said this yesterday to somebody, like every morning we wake up and get punched in the face, as a thank you for working in the music business. It's been impossible. Mm. It's a horrible time to have a record label, but, it's changed really rapidly. And, you know, I'm at peace with the fact that we're not going to be in a TikTok world or whatever comes next. You know, we'll definitely service stuff digitally and that's great. But you know, back to, you know, earlier in this conversation, I really like making the thing. I like a thing. And, you know, people's, appetite for the thing continues to change. I keep waiting for the next thing, you know, like for a while, you know, it looked like there were, going to be some, different sorts of, you know, surround sound things, you know, going from quad to, you know, DP audio and all that stuff. And now they're trying to do it digitally with, you know, immersive audio.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of feel like, you know, the idea about, you know, a vinyl resurgence was, that was more a press angle than it was total reality. I mean, certainly, you know, vinyl's an interesting thing now, and it's you need to consider it and make it for certain artists and certain records. But CDs kind of still sell the most of everything globally.
So will more people buy the Ghost Is Born CD deluxe set than the LP deluxe set?
I don't know. It's too early to tell on that one. I don't know what the splits are, but possibly. I'd have to go back and look at what A Ghost Is Born did. Because, you know, the big sets, especially that era of music, the CDs make the most sense because they came out in the CD era. So to try and sequence records that were made for CDs is a little wonky, you know, that's why you wind up with three sides of vinyl.
Right.
You know? So, but yeah, I'm not in, you know, that those records are on Nonesuch, and I don't always see their sales stuff. So I don't know, but I can tell you from the things that we release on Omnivore, you know, 9.999 times out of 10, the CD will sell more than vinyl. And I know everybody wants their records on vinyl, but post COVID, it's the materials are ridiculously expensive. I mean, even cost for CDs went up. So I find myself, if I go, you know, to a record store, records are $25, $30, $40, sometimes $50 if you're buying them plus shipping. That's a lot for a single LP.
Sure.
So well,
there's a lot more emphasis now on, and I can back this up at least a little anecdotally on, you know, like the AAA mastering and just from the original master tapes, all analog, this, that, and the other thing. Yeah. And like, it's weird. Like in this, in the episodes that I've done, the ones with the mastering engineers have more downloads and listeners than a lot of the artists who you're crazy about.
And
now again, it's a niche, you know, of people who are devoted to that. Does that mean that, you know, like thousands and thousands of people are going to buy, you know, a $50 record? You know, I don't know. I think that there's sort of a glut of it too, but it seems like the values have shifted a little bit. I don't know.
Well, I think that's price driven. You know, the people, I mean, there's $500 records if you want to buy them, you know. You know, I've bought a few of the One Steps and I'm like, meh. You know, I mean, I love good audio, but I love vinyl. But here's the thing, you know, we finally learned how to master for digital, right? So high resolution digital is fantastic. It's probably the most accurate representation of what's on tape, of that analog sound wave, right? And that's just kind of the truth. Unless you're sitting there with the master tape, which sometimes also does not sound good. You know, it's like, I think especially a lot of super audiophile people the presumption is that that piece of tape is pristine. And somehow if there's a flaw in their vinyl that, it was introduced somehow by some devious producer like myself, right, or it's a bad cut, or the plating was wrong, or a million other things. Well, guess what? A lot of times the flaw was on the original master, and we have to go in sometimes and digitally fix it. So, you know, they complain about the digital being introduced into the chain. And I'm like, you have no idea. You have no idea. Like, to make things sound good, yeah, sometimes you have to do that. Our tools are so great now in the digital world. And this is from a person who loves the thing. You know, I'm not going to turn down a good tool, though. Like, I'm not going to not use this hammer if this is the thing that's going to get the job done, you know? So I have a fraught relationship with the audiophile world and the expectations, because the reality is you're not always starting from perfect.
Right. And if you're doing a box set, like Keep Your Eye on the Sky or one of those, you just can get so much more onto a CD. And
you can. Yeah.
And also, that's like an older recording, but anything that was recorded in the last like 30 years is likely to have not been, you know, analog tape in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, some things are and some things are, and for better or worse. I think we're going to lose more of our catalog music after the introduction of recording to digital than we will what's on tape. And I say this as someone who has to go back 20 years now, as opposed to 1957, and those tapes are great. But 20 years ago, you have 50-pin connectors. Those don't plug into anything anymore. So we're losing a lot because drives aren't spinning up, but also drives and all of the software, firmware, it's all being updated. So we're losing all kinds of stuff because of the rapid changes in technology. And I know, you know, a great example of just sort of my life is, you know, we put out the giant Yankee Hotel Foxtrot box set. And that was a Rubik's cube of a project. I loved every second of it, but to figure out what to present and how to present it, and there was an enormous amount of material. But one of the complaints was, well, where are the recording dates? And I'm like, well, let's see. I had CDRs that some of them were blank. One of them said Gore on Gore. And I'm like, funny guys, you guys are right. Funny. Huh. There's no recording date. You know, they're on cassettes. They're on mini discs. They're on all of this stuff. And I didn't necessarily have the recording dates. Right. So the complaint was, well, we need to know which version came first. And I'm like, I can't tell you that. I'm not going to make up a bunch of dates for you guys. But that's, you know, that's where when you take recording out of the studio system, where like somebody's job was actually to sit there, write down the information, file it with the union. It's probably on the tape box or on the sheets inside, the tracking sheets. You have none of that, you know, when you have a drive that you can't even access because you need somebody that has all of the conversion stuff to extract what's on there from a 50-pin connector.
And you don't even know. And the artist owns the studio and could go in whenever they want.
Yeah. Yeah. And that one was a really interesting project because even if I had the original date from the start of what would become, you know, a final version of the song that made the record, they redid so much in the mix that I can't even tell you if any of the original was used on a few of the songs. So I'm like, well, they may have started it on this date, but if nothing made it from the original multi-track to the final song, when was that song recorded?
Yeah. <You
know?
laughs> Yeah, no, there was, yeah, because there was so much work on that with Jim O'Rourke and everyone else.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you know, so how did you get connected with Jeff Tweedy and Wilco to do these massive projects?
Yeah, kind of behind the scenes people, you know, their lawyer and I had known each other for a long time. And then he introduced me to their then manager, Tony. And, you know, it's me rolling around in the business. I think you wind up finding, you know, your people. And being a Milwaukee girl and having been in the Chicago music ecosystem to a degree. I mean, we'd go down there every chance we got for shows that weren't coming to Milwaukee. You know, so I was at Lounge Axe. I was loving XRT all the way to Beloit, where it would cut out. You know,
there you go.
But so you know, I do think over the last 30 years in the business that if you kept at it and you were, you know, you made your way through the labels kind of like I did, you just wind up finding people that share the same, you know, music that you do. And so that was just sort of thing. It was like, I hate to use the word organic, but it was very organic. And we all kind of love the same stuff. So
would Jeff just give you like a box full of stuff and say, here, I found this under the bed or wherever you told him to look?
Well, all the guys are great. It's, you know, up until this record, we've had a rotating cast of characters, right? So some folks are gone from the band and new people came in. So I'm actually looking forward to going forward because now I can bug Pat and Nels about stuff, you know?
There you go.
From
Sky Blue Sky onward, you got the same lineup. So
yeah. So I'll be curious to see what those guys have. But Glenn had a bunch of stuff for Yankee because he was just coming into the band, and so he was learning the songs. So he was taking home, you know, what essentially were like dailies on CDs and stuff. You know, they have some stuff at the Loft up through the next couple records. There's the Warner Vault stuff. So I, you know, they kind of let me roam freely. I ask them when I need things, and they are they're Johnny on the spot and forthcoming, and you know, whatever they can help get to me, they do. So
was there a lot of back and forth on what you wanted to do versus what they wanted you to do, or were you pretty much able to say, hey, look, this is the best version of this we can have, and they're like, great?
Yeah, more the latter, because unlike some of the older artists I've dealt with, these guys are more my age. And so they came up with, you know, in the transition to sort of reissues and compilations and box sets. So they understand it more. I think there are a lot of older artists that don't, they're like, well, this is the version that that was released, and that's the only thing that people can ever hear, because that was my intent. And, you know, I think the Wilco guys, and Jeff is really open to this. They're like, there's nothing flawed or embarrassing about our work in progress, you know? And if you think it's valuable to the fans to, have access to that, who are we to say no? You know, it's like you become a different sort of filter. But in this instance, they let me do my job, you know, and I it's just a blast, because I can really super nerd out and super serve the super nerds.
There you go. You know?
Early on, I said, what if we collected as many of the extraneous B-sides and soundtracks as tracks and compilation, like radio compilation tracks, as we could, and put it in one place, so we don't have to reprise that on the reissues. You know, there's some valuable retail space there that you know, I don't want to resell stuff that people already have. So we did the Alpha Mike Foxtrot box, right, which was all the B-sides and stuff. And I'm really glad that they were into that, because I don't have to, you know, on Ghost, I reprised a few tracks because I thought they were really sort of important to the canon, you know, like, and so I think there's maybe three or four tracks that I felt were important, but I think on Yankee, there's nothing. And so I had the flexibility of all of that space to get more previously unissued material out, and they allow for that. But I love that they're like, there's nothing embarrassing about, you know, what we record. We're trying to find our way to the song that we think it is, you know.
And they embrace the process for it, which is helpful. Yeah. Instead of being like, well, the only thing that matters is the result, not the process.
Right. Right. Yeah, so that's been a lot of fun, and it's really a real gas, you know, for someone like me to be able to say, well, in a perfect world, you know, I would do X, Y, and Z. I get all these box sets, and I'm like, oh, that's disappointing. There's nothing disappointing to me about these projects with Wilco, because they really, you know, I got to maximize what I thought was the best things for them, which is highly unusual.
So are you already at work on Sky Blue Skybox, or is that, you know, to be determined?
I've learned to start these things just when I find things. So I have little buckets for everything going forward. Cause you know, if they'll have me, you know, but I think, you know, so, some of these require some deeper dives. And so I've started everything.
What, do you have any other sort of dream projects where, I mean, like, again, the Stax one just took forever and was such a deep dive. Is there something else like that on the horizon that you want to happen, or that we don't know about?
Yeah.
Oh, we're being cagey.
Ah!
Okay. All right. We'll have to do part two of this sometime when you, the big reveal.
I'll tell you, so Record Store Day, we're releasing a bunch of demos that Doc Pomus and mostly Mort Schumann wrote and recorded for Elvis. So that one's super fun. And
that's for this Record Store Day.
Yeah. So, you know, We spent time, Audrey and I, and my restoration mastering main guy, Michael Graves, and his wife, Joy, who works at the studio with him. We went to New York to meet Sharon Felder, Doc's daughter. And we spent a week transferring all the acetates she had. And it's really cool, you know, to hear Mort Schumann, you know, doing his latest flame, you know. It's just, and it's so funny because Mort was a vocal sort of chameleon. So when they were doing these cutting these songs that they were going to pitch to Elvis, he like becomes the Elvis voice, you know.
There you go.
So it's a real fun listen. So that's sort of, there's some hints and all that for you. Cool. But yeah, there's a ton of stuff. There's an infinite amount of music out there, and I'd like to get to as much of it as I can. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones. Yeah, I always hate to talk about stuff before it's out because sometimes they go south for whatever reason, or, you know, get delayed for 17 years. You know, it's one of those things where I hate to get people's hopes up on something, but you know, if the winds blow kindly this year, there's going to be some pretty cool projects specifically for Omnivore. So,
all right, well, you'll have to keep us posted on that.
I will.
But yeah, no, this is really fun. And again,
yeah,
you've worked
you
on
some. Thank you for having me. This is super fun. This is the happiest thing I've done since a while. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry that's true. And I'm sorry for all the stuff that's going on with your house. So
I appreciate that.
All right.
This is fun.
That's it for episode 176 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Cheryl Pavelski for shining a light on all the super cool projects she's worked on while giving us insights into her challenging industry. Go to omnivorerecordings.com to shop her label's vast catalog, which includes the new first-ever CD release of the Iron City House Rockers' third album, Blood on the Bricks, plus 11 bonus tracks. Omnivore also has 3 Record Store Day releases on Saturday, April 12th, from Doc Pomus, Francois Hardy, and the Rembrandts. Seek out None Such Records, deluxe editions of Wilco's A Ghost Is Born and Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, and other Wilco boxes as well. You could find Pavelski on Instagram. We wish her and Audrey the best as they deal with the loss of their home in Altadena. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who in his other life is a heavy metal drummer. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You could follow me as well at Mark Caro, at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.